Okay, folks, no time like the present. Offshore radio, broadcasting from ships or other structures to be outside the territorial limit and therefore not covered by the laws of the country you're aiming at. Well, it didn't start off the coast of England, nor even of Holland. It kicked off in the late 1950s and early 1960s in Scandinavia with stations beaming to Sweden and Denmark. And have a look at the big ship there. It'll come back later. At the time, that was the Bonjour, which hosts a station called Radio Nord. Now, the early story. Well, it kicks off with this guy, the O'Rahilly, famous for one of the people who traveled around the country, tried to call off the 1916 Rising, and having done that, arrived in Dublin and says, ah, sure, look, I'll join in anyway. I've wound the clock, so I might as well hear it chime. Well, the O'Rahilly had a son, and the son had a shipyard in Greenore in County Louth. And that son had another son, and his name was Ronan. Ronan O'Rahilly, the founder of Radio Caroline. In early 1964, a ship called the Fredericia, an old ferry, sails from Rotterdam into Greenore Harbour, where she's fitted out as a radio ship. Now, meantime, there was another operator, a man called Alan Crawford, a music publisher from Australia, who also had a plan to set up a station on a ship aimed at Britain. O'Rahilly agreed that the second project could also use Greenore outfitting. Why this station was to be Radio Atlanta. Apparently, a lot of their better equipment disappeared and ended up on the Caroline ship, which was probably one of the reasons why they were happy for their competitor to be outfitted beside them. Now, Radio Atlanta itself didn't last long. By the standards of the mid-60s, it was a boring station. It was, sort of music south of the border and, quarter of an hour of the organist entertains and so on. It wasn't making money at all. So very quickly, Atlanta and Caroline merged with, you had Radio Caroline North off the Isle of Man, which those of us of a certain age would remember getting here in Ireland, and Radio Caroline South, the former Atlanta ship, down in the Thames Estuary beaming to London. And they carried on broadcasting after 1967, when the British made offshore broadcasting illegal. The two Caroline ships continued. But at this stage, the major shareholder in the Caroline organisation was a man called Philip Solomon. Himself and his brother, Mervyn, they were the people who owned major minor records. They owned all sorts of music publishing firms, and did their fingers in practically everything to do with music, records, dance halls, show bands, you name it. They ended up as the majority shareholders in Caroline. Well, Philip, he didn't like paying bills. I just didn't like paying bills. So the two things you could say he was responsible for in Caroline was, one, a top 30 format that had loads of plugs for his major minor records. So you could get The Who, followed by The Hollies, followed by The Monkees, followed by Bridie Gallagher with the turf cutter from RD. But Solomon also, he liked to hang on to his money. And not a lot of advertising was coming in. It was mainly money for plugging records. And by March 1968, the following year, their supply company, the Wise Brothers in Holland, who tendered the two ships, brought their crews, brought their food, brought their diesel oil, brought their fresh water and so on. Well, they got really browned off with not being paid. So they sent a couple of tugs out, seized the ships and towed them into harbour in Holland. But 4 years later, one of the ships, the Mi Amigo, was back at sea, not in a great condition, but it carried on broadcasting right up to 1980 when it sank. Was that the end of Caroline? Not at all. 3 years later, it was back from a bigger and better ship, the Ross Revenge. Have a look at the guy sitting inside the aerial mast up there. Now, look at the guy with the black curly hair, fourth one along. Does anyone recognize him? He's changed a bit. Well, today, he was then known as Tony Garrett. He lasted less than a week on Caroline, I think, because of extreme seasickness. He had to come off, I think, after about 5 days. Well, that's him today, Gareth O'Callaghan on 4FM. That gives you an idea of what the Ross Revenge was like, and it had, what I believe, the tallest mast ever put on a ship. It was 300 feet high. Now, it didn't stay there for the entire length of their broadcasting career, because as tends to happen with masts at sea, they come down, and indeed it did sometime later. Gives you an idea of the state of the ship when it went to sea in 1983 and just a couple of years later, because you can't pull into port to get, you know, a quick clean-up. The ships were, they were known as the Rusty Ships, and it was for a very good reason. And also, another couple of connections. There's Gareth O'Callaghan again with, sometimes at this parish, Steve Conway, who was a DJ and newsreader on Radio Caroline, and also his brother, Chris Kennedy. Now move on to, oh, and I must mention this. Philip Solomon, before he died, gave an interview. In fact, it was to a British, a BBC local radio station. The Sunday World just lifted it, where he said he'd paid a substantial bribe to Haughey. Now, I can well believe that. I'm just not sure what the bribe was for, because Caroline was not dependent on anything in Ireland to keep broadcasting after the British made it illegal. Myself, I would wonder whether the bribe was actually in relation to Sunshine Radio, because Philip Solomon was also director of Sunshine Radio, along with Robbie Dale and a number of Fianna Fáil people like Lady Valerie Goulding. To me, that would have made more sense, but we'd probably never know, as Philip Solomon died a few years ago, and his brother Mervyn, in his whole lifetime, I think has never said more than a half dozen sentences about his involvement with the clandestine or illegal radio. Anyway, what's this thing? You can broadcast from a ship, okay, but what about building your own artificial island out in the North Sea? Well, in 1964, some Dutch business people got together and they decided that they would build an artificial structure, a bit like an oil platform or that, out in the North Sea, way outside territorial waters. That would make them dead safe. They'd have a permanent base. They wouldn't be rocking and rolling. There's no danger of them drifting. It seemed ideal. And they were going to put a radio and a television station on it. Radio Noordzee and TV Noordzee. Now, Radio Noordzee wasn't the first offshore station in Holland. Since 1960, Radio Veronica had been broadcasting and been very, very popular with the Dutch public. But the TV station would certainly break the state monopoly. And this was at a time when most European countries, both radio and TV, well, they were in short supply. They tended to be government-owned, and they tended to try to cater for everybody. So it meant that, you know, like, say, in relation to music, you got maybe a couple of hours a week of current stuff, because you're getting a couple of hours of everything. So there was not enough of anything for anyone. Television was pretty dire as well. Most people had a single channel, most countries. And, sort of from tea time till maybe 10:30 at night, you know, very, very different to now. Gives an idea sort of the size of it. Now, TV Noordzee, it was a roaring success. And you really have to wonder why, when one of its star programs was Mr. Ed the Talking Horse. They also had Mr. Magoo. I don't know if people remember Mr. Magoo. And Rin Tin Tin, the army dog. Of course, they did also have a few other programs like The Saint, Robin Hood, Danger Man, and Wagon Train. The REM Island, as it was known, REM for the business that they had set up to run it. Where was it built? Well, would you believe it was built in Cove? One of the investors was Cornelius Verome, who owns the Verome Dockyards down in Cove, which is still there today. So it was built, taken out the North Sea in sections, planted on the floor of the ocean, and the government did not like it. Oh, the government did not like it at all. The radio station was on during the day, and it would publicise the TV. And then the radio station would go off at tea time, and the TV station would come on. It was so successful that they issued 7 million shares, 7 million guilders worth of shares at the beginning. And the share price was 20 guilders. Within 10 days of going on the air, their commercial success was such, the amount of advertising money they were putting in, that the share price had risen to 143 guilders. So from 20 guilders to 143 gives an idea of the sort of money that they were putting in. They only lasted 4 months. The Dutch government said, but it's not a ship. It's anchored on the sea floor. And we found this obscure bit of legislation about, continental shelves and so on. So actually, if you're anchored, we can measure from there. So they decided, anyway, it was Dutch property. It was part of Dutch territory. It was not in international waters. The TV station closed down. The radio station stayed on the air. 2 days later, helicopters overhead, police commandos came down the mast. Daft thing to do. They could have fried themselves. And a load of police boats came out. That was the end of radio and TV Noordzee. Or was it? I'll come back to that in just a moment. It lay abandoned for a while, part of the time being used by the Dutch government as a base for people doing marine research. But then, some years ago, it was dismantled, taken ashore, given a fit of the paint job, and it's now in Rotterdam. But I say they were there for 4 months, but they've been very cute. They said that they'd spent about £1 million pounds in terms of everything that the two stations had cost. They'd pulled in more advertising than they could cope with as soon as they went on air. They were charging between £600 and £800 pounds a minute. And this was back in the mid-60s. I don't know if that's the equivalent to now, 10 grand a minute or something. But they'd been, as well as that money, they'd been very cute. They'd managed to insure themselves with Lloyd's of London for £800,000 pounds in the event of closure by government action. So despite being on the air for only 4 months, it looks like they actually made a profit from the whole thing. Now, a lightship. There was a lightship in Dunleary Harbour known as the Comet. And when it was decommissioned, it was sold to a man called Tommy Shields in Glasgow. Now, the Comet had been built on the Clyde right back in 1904, and it's been a long, long time as Dunleary Harbour's lightship. Tommy Shields bought it, and he decided to turn it into a radio station, which became Radio Scotland. And probably not the best ship to be on. It was a hulk. It had no engines. Because a light ship doesn't get moved. It just gets firmly anchored somewhere. But radio ships do tend to get moved. While they had no accidents with Radio Scotland, I don't know if I'd want to be on a decrepit, rusty old ship with no engines in the middle of winter. But maybe that's just a matter of personal choice. Anyway, they were off Glasgow, broadcasting away. They thought they were not just 3 miles off coast. They thought they were about 4.5 miles. And then it was pointed out to them that, well by a court, that no, actually, the way we draw bays and estuaries means that you're actually 100 miles inside territorial waters. So they got a small fine, and they had to up anchor and get towed very quickly. And where did they get towed to? Just off Ballywalter in County Down. So overnight, they became Radio Scotland and Ireland. Problem, though, while the signal was getting into Ireland very well, it was getting into north of England very well, but Scotland itself, not so good. So they changed their name to Radio 242 and thought they'd settle with that market. But then there were complaints that they may have been causing interference to lighthouse communications on the northeast of Ireland. So at the end of April, it was back to the Scottish coast. So Radio Scotland and Ireland, it was short-lived. It was about 6 weeks. Now, here comes one that maybe some people won't have come across. In the 1970s, another radio ship, the Deep Diver, was equipped in Ireland. And it was to house a station known as Radio Sunshine. And involved in putting it together were Chris Carey, later of Radio Nova, and Dick Palmer, who had been on Radio Carolina and had served as its captain at various stages. So in 1977, the ship was partly equipped as a radio station in Belfast Harbour. And what they told the harbour authorities to divert suspicion was that it was a lighting ship for the film industry. Bob Noakes and Robbie Robinson, both of whom had been involved in Caroline before, they joined the project, which, like most offshore radio projects, seemed to be constantly suffering from either a lack of money or leakage of the money that they already had. In April of 78, the ship left Belfast, allegedly going to Portugal to broadcast to tourists there. Like, load of nonsense. Like, there'd be no money in going up and down the coast broadcasting to tourists. Obviously, they were heading for the Thames estuary, because that's where the really big market is, the southeast of England. Now, you can have a look at the ship. It doesn't look great. And look at the size of it, because that's what, although it's a bad photo, that's why we used it. You can see the guy and the child there. The idea that this would be years out at sea, in maybe force 9, force 10 gales, you know, off London, madness, absolute madness. They sailed out of Belfast Harbour. They got no further than Cornwall, and of course it broke down and had to be towed into the Scilly Isles. That was the end of that project. The people who subsequently bought the ship bought it as like a holiday thing, and they actually did go to Portugal, where they ended up running aground after the steering system failed. But 3 years later, in 1980, Kerry and Robinson came up with another plan to launch a pirate radio ship that would allegedly this time be broadcasting to tourists in Spain. Of course, again, we know that they were planning to go to London. A ship was purchased, apparently, and brought to Watford Harbour with a view to fitting it out. And it was also called Sunshine Radio. But again, it appears one of those things where the promised money from investors didn't all arrive, and the project just died to death. But around the same time, Philip Solomon had met up with a couple of business people who wanted to set up yet another radio station on Britain's south coast. Solomon put up the money to buy a ship in Hamburg, and ironically, the ship that they decided to buy had been used previously in another sort of offshore dodgy business. It had been an offshore supermarket shop. They'd anchor it 3 miles outside the territorial waters, and that way that VAT and other taxes didn't apply. So you could go out and on a boat and do your weekly shopping, like, you know, without paying any VAT, until, of course, the Germans clamped down on that. And once again, the money for the project didn't all turn up and the project died. But what remained out of it was that Kerry, Robinson and Solomon had met again, and a jingle package had been made for Sunshine Radio. So, of course, we ended up with Sunshine Radio. Robbie Robinson, Chris Kerry and Philip Solomon set up Sunshine out in Port Marnock, which probably became the number two station in the greater Dublin area after Nova. Kerry was involved at the beginning, but they were only on the air about a day, and person unknown, that would be Eamon Cook of Radio Dublin, went out and blew up their mast. Kerry took fright and scurried back to England. Robinson and Solomon sold his shares, and Robinson decided to stick with it and made Sunshine into quite a success. Now, this ship, does anyone know what it is? What station was on this ship? They weren't on the air for very long. That's right, Radio Paradise. In 1981, yet another group of would-be pirates had got another ship, and it was anchored in the heart of Dublin on the quays. I think it was on John Rogerson's quay. On their way here, they had actually run into a Force 13 storm. A lot of damage was done to the ship, and they had to broadcast an SOS. Anyway, they got themselves fixed up enough to arrive up the Liffey on March the 11th of 81. And work commenced on installing broadcasting equipment under the disguise that the ship was being fitted out for marine life research. That would explain like record decks and record libraries. And though apparently customs fell for it. And who erected the mast on the ship? But yeah, another dub. Sammy Prendergast, Prendergast Aerials, who also ran Sammy's Late Night Shop in Weaver Square in the Liberties, and Liberty's local community radio, later Liberty 104. And I would think that probably at least at one in three of all the serious radio masts in Ireland, like, you know, ones that people paid money for rather than make themselves, it was probably Sammy Prendergast who had put them up for them. Well, and Sammy got 40 grand for putting up the 280-foot-high aerial mast. work that was all carried out in a few hours just before the ship departed. And it departed in a hurry, because while customs mightn't have been aware of what was going on, other people must have been, because a large crowd had assembled on the quays to wave to it as it sailed off. But just before it went, a last-minute visitor was Chris Carey, who wandered in and, like, you're going nowhere, this won't work. I tell you what, I'll give you $250,000 American dollars for everything, the ship, all the equipment, the lot. And apparently Ben Bowd, the man behind the project, well, he'd had previous dealings with Carey where money had gone missing and such like. And Carey was helped off the ship. I believe he landed on his hands and knees on the quayside. The ship did leave Dublin in a hurry, headed for Holland. On their way across to Holland, of test transmissions. That was the only broadcasting from Radite, because one, the top half of the mast collapsed because they'd left in such a hurry it hadn't been stayed properly. And secondly, and much more importantly, while they were heading towards Holland, the Dutch Navy was heading towards them. Although they were in international waters, the Dutch Navy boarded them, seized the ship and towed it into harbour. A resultant court case went on for about 5 years. And at the end of the day, the owners got their ship back and got sizable compensation, because 5 years left tied up at the back end of a dock when the ship had deteriorated a lot. So again, it seems like the owners made a profit out of this, despite the fact they'd only broadcast for 2 hours and to nobody in particular. That was a police coming to visit them as well, and there they are being towed in. Now, our last ship that we're going to look at today, and truly a rusty ship, Radio Laser 558, laser hot hit. When Laser arrived on the scene in 1984, everyone was told this is an entirely American-financed, American-staffed, American-backed operation. We're not covered by British law. We're not covered by European law. We're in international waters. Everything's American. Well, the only thing American about it, I think, was a post office box in New York and a scam artist who had been employed over there to allegedly sell advertising for them. Now, it appears he collected about $500,000 in wages and commissions, but he never delivered any advertising at all. Nice work if you can get it. The money behind Laser came, every penny of it, came from an Irish multimillionaire, Philip Smith, the man who used to own Saks Hotel out in Donnybrook. Interesting chap, given especially that his brother, Paul Smith, at the time was a Garda assistant chief superintendent. Smith apparently had been previously offered a stake in Radio Nova, but had been slow in making up his mind. This time, when somebody suggested maybe he might like a radio station on a ship, he jumped at it. A ship was bought, taken all the way over to America for a refit, then sailed back to New Ross, where the final work was done on it. And where its very first broadcast was made, Smith had travelled down to New Ross to have a look at his new toy. And the first transmission was sort of for his ego. They played his favourite songs from the ship while they were in harbour, which would seem a pretty daft thing to do. If you've invested maybe a couple of $100,000 in a ship and all the equipment and that, and then you go do broadcasting from the harbour, like not from international waters, you're just asking to be seized. It has happened to other ships before, but they got away with it this time. After a week in New Ross, the story about the ship being an oil exploration rig was getting a bit thin, and they headed off for the Thames estuary. Now, by late 1984, Laser had about 5 million listeners in Britain, maybe the same in the rest of Europe, but very, very little advertising. They did have a novelty as well. When they started broadcasting, they didn't have a big broadcasting mast. That was a helium-filled balloon. Apparently, these are used by the American Navy in some parts of the world. So the idea is that this balloon would hold your aerial up. It would reduce costs fantastically. Except that the first one, well, after I think it was less than half an hour that the balloon, it just blew away, like disappeared, never found again. They got a second one for 11 grand. And I think it was up for a few minutes. And it blew away. So then they had to go for the standard stuff. By this stage, although they had a lot of listeners, they weren't putting in much in the way of money because, well, no British firm was going to advertise with them because that was illegal. They'd be prosecuted under the Marine Defence Act. And Smith had been sold the idea, well, you'll get pan-European, people who aren't tied to one country like Coca-Cola or McDonald's or something like that. And that's also rubbish because the way these things work is you have Coca-Cola Ireland and Coca-Cola Germany. And one's not going to pay for advertising for the other. It doesn't work like that. So the only real money that was coming in again was for plugging records. You wanted your record played on the ship, but if you had the cash. One other thing that made Laser Baby unique, it was the first offshore station and possibly the first, if you like, big radio station, you know, it could count its listenership in the millions, that at various times had a majority of women DJs. When you think back of other radio stations that era, they might have had one or two women broadcasting on them, often not for a very long period, and they were usually only referred to by their first name, something that bloke. You know, they'd just be Eleanor, Samantha, something like that. With Laser, they had, a lot of the time, it was a majority of women broadcasters, people like Chris Carson, Liz West, Susan Charles, and so on, some of whom ended up doing gigs on Irish pirate stations in the late 80s. But anyway, while Laser was having this problem, Smith didn't want to put more money into it. They had an audience, but they couldn't sell that audience to the advertisers. And then in August of 1985, the British government were getting a lot of pressure from the legal commercial stations in the southeast of England that this ship was taking away its youth their youth audience, and they wanted it shut down. So Euro Siege commenced, where the British government sent a ship out to sit beside the communicator, as the Laser ship was known, to make sure that no supplies of oil, food, staff changes, new records or that could get to it. Things did get pretty hairy. They ran out of water, which is, you know, pretty serious. They ran out of food. They almost ran out of diesel oil. I think they had enough just to keep a couple of lights going on the ship so that they wouldn't get banged into by the ferry going over to Holland. At the end of the day, when it got down to the stage of not even any toilet paper on the ship, the crew said, right, that's it. And they agreed that the ship would be towed by the authorities into Harwich. And was that the end of it? Well, not really. 4 months later, the ship was bought by a guy called Ray Anderson, who had been involved with other offshore ventures. And he got it for 35 grand. And in November, it slipped out to sea and started broadcasting as Laser Hot Hit. It was short-lived because it had exactly the same problems. They could get an audience, but they couldn't turn it into cash. So Laser Hot Hits didn't last very long. But the ship itself did as a radio ship. Again, like the ability of all these people not to lose money, no matter how belly up their projects go. Because what the ship was used for from then on was as a base for stations that were moving studios in Holland. So Radio Hollandia, Radio 12, 24, various others. They might be, you know, they moved in, say, the equivalent of, say, into the center of town, and it's going to be a couple of months they're on the move. So the ship would anchor quite close to you because it would all be quite legal, and you'd broadcast from the ship while the move was going on. And they got about a half dozen different gigs that way, the final one being for a very small station with very big ideas, which called itself the Super Station. It was a small community station up in the Orkney Islands, and that's where it served its very last one and then was broken up and is no more. And that's it. There is an awful lot more to be said about Irish connections with radio, and there's, you know, we haven't even looked at all the dodgy money connections and people's minders and all that. That's for another day. But let nobody tell you it was just a few people listening to Radio Caroline for a couple of years. There truly was lots of piracy and buccaneering behaviour and a bit of crack as well.